Somebody put a bag of drugs inside me. I need you to take it out. It's leaking.
Hello! Welcome to episode 24 of Popcorn and Prosecco, a movie podcast where we talk about movies, movies, movies. This week, we're going to be reviewing Lucy and Magic in the Moonlight. But since Perry Nemiroff and Angie Hahn are at Comic-Con, we're going to have a special third segment just from them. So joining me for the review sections, I have two very special guests, Jason and Max.
Hello.
Hooray for Hollywood. Hello.
All right, so we're going to start off this podcast by talking about the new Woody Allen film, Magic in the Moonlight. You want to take it, Max?
Yes. It's the Roaring Twenties. Oscar winner for The King's Speech, Colin Firth plays Stanley, a world-renowned yellow-faced magician who uncovers fraudulent psychics and clairvoyants on a regular basis until he meets the comely Sophie. Played by the irrepressibly adorable Emma Stone, Sophie is a spiritualist who has gotten her hooks into a wealthy family who believes she can really commune with the dead. A rich family's home in the south of France to expose Sophie once and for all. But could this saucy spiritualist be the real deal? Once the pragmatic Stanley becomes smitten with her, he thinks she could be.
Holy shit, yeah, that's by far the best.
In the moonlight.
That's the best, I think, plot synopsis we've ever had on this show, so cheers to you. And in character, no less. So, Max, why don't you kick up the discussion? What did you think of Magic in the Moonlight?
This is strictly, like, Woody's spinning his wheels. This is not, like, A++ Woody. This is, like, medium level Woody. This is just him like, hey, I'm making a movie. It has people in it and they have dialogue and there are scenes and it's like it's really forgettable. And
I was actually pretty disappointed in this one just because watching it like about 20 minutes in, I was like, oh, it's Pride and Prejudice, but like with Harry Houdini and Woody Allen stuff mixed in. And I was really excited about that idea, but it doesn't pay off on those things for me. I think it's partially because I agree with you in your description, Emma Stone. She's adorable in this movie, and I'm like, of course everyone loves her. She's delightful. I believe she's a spiritist. I believe anything she says because she's so damn cute. But, like, they screw up the chemistry of the Darcy and the Elizabeth for me, where Elizabeth is just radiant instead of kind of edgy, where, like, in most versions of Pride and Prejudice, you mostly like Lizzie, but then she can be kind of a pill. So you kind of get it. But, like, in this, it's like Sophie's just so darling. And then the Darcy character is just such an old crank. I just couldn't get on board, and I couldn't get excited for the two of them being together. And I'm not going to lie, the age difference, which I think is, like, 53 and 25, I know it's a Woody Allen thing, but it's not super romantic for me. But I had an interesting conversation with Jason after the movie where you were talking more about it in the kind of the grander concept of Woody Allen. So do you want to take it?
Well, yeah, I mean, I feel like I can look at the film in two ways. I can sort of see it through two prisms. Like, if you're just looking at it as a, you know, sparkling little romantic comedy with Colin Firth and Emma Stone, like, it, on most levels, it does not work. It is weirdly overwritten. The pace is way off. He can be touch and go with exposition, and it's way over expositionized. I've just made up a word. But, like, seriously, there are, like, three or four scenes in a row in the first act where he keeps explaining what the premise is and what is going to happen in a very, like, yes, we get it kind of way.
And then he takes really long times to get to points where we know where he's heading. Like, there's a very long scene where one character's playing solitaire and stepping another character through the mental process he needs to get through. You're just like, we understand. And you're literally playing solitaire for, like, 10 minutes.
Right. And more importantly...
Yeah, there's also the character...
No, go ahead.
Oh, there's the character who, I don't know, if are we going to spoil? Are we spoiling?
Not I don't know what you're reaching
spoil
for.
Or not to spoil. Let's just say there is a character in this film who kind of functions as like a twist. There's a twist with this character, and if you don't see this twist coming within the first 10 minutes of the film... Like, you need to turn in your card. Like, you're done. You really need to go.
Well, that's not true. If you've never seen a movie before, that might be quite a surprise. I mean, I actually think the movie functions really well as an homage to, like, old school movies. Like, it reminded me, the way it's shot, it reminded me a lot of, like, kind of Hitchcock era, where, like, the cinematography equipment we had wasn't quite as sweet, so some things looked a little clunky, but, like, showed you beautiful things. But it's, like, it's not ambitious. It's just, like, if you're just going to do an homage, like, there are movies this could have been already. It just, I was disappointed that there wasn't something more to this.
Yeah. My main real disappointment, I mean, above and beyond any of the sort of pacing issues or problems in the structure, is just that it's not funny enough. You keep feeling like all of the sort of all of the window dressing is in place for this sort of like snappy screwball comedy, and it doesn't really zip the way it needs to. It just sort of crawls in a strange way.
There's no bon mots. There's no like sort of snappy back and forth. It's like it is like a 1930s programmer that you would see on Turner Classic Movies and be like, I'll kill an hour with this thing.
Right. So, but all of those sort of those are all of the things where like you know, average moviegoer with only maybe even a passing interest in Woody Allen will probably come away with those things, and really that should be the audience that anything he's making is appealing to, and
sure.
So I'm by no means saying that any of the sort of asterisk interest points that I'm gonna get into briefly make it somehow something that you have to run right out and see. But what I
but
did
as
think,
someone who literally wrote the book on Woody Allen,
right? I have a book coming out in the fall that is a full filmography. I spent the better part of last year like rewatching everything he'd done and writing about every film and writing about recurring themes and pulling everything in and so forth and so on. And from that perspective, as someone studying it as a piece of the Woody puzzle, there are things here that are interesting. We've got a character, a protagonist who's in his 50s, but whose concerns about mortality and what happens after we die and sort of spirituality are much more in tune, I thought, with the 78, 79-year-old man who wrote it. This is him sort of wrestling with growing old and thinking about what happens after you die in a way that we really haven't seen him do as an older man. There was a lot of it in sort of the younger films, but it hasn't really been a preoccupation much lately. And so I think, you know, there are some textual things about that, about it in that regard that are interesting. And also, honestly, it's his most, it's the most interested he's been in questions of faith since probably Crimes and Misdemeanors.
Yeah, and I was actually really excited about that, because to explain to people who haven't seen the movie yet, Sophie represents spiritualism, but to a grander sense, faith in, like, God and an afterlife and all these things, whereas the Colin Firth character, Stanley, the Colin Firth character is an atheist, he doesn't believe
Stanley.
In an afterlife. Yeah, and he, because he fears his own mortality, he would love to believe in these things, but his rationale won't allow him. And that's one of the central conflicts of the film, which is very interesting, but it's like, and I mean, on some level, I didn't expect much more from Woody Allen, who has a very kind of like New York, neurotic, overly rational sense of thinking, but it's really dismissive of ideas of faith, which I was surprisingly offended by.
I wasn't,
sure.
But I mean, I'm stone cold atheist. I'm not a faith person,
but I just thought it was kind of insulting where it seemed like anybody who had faith in the afterlife was treated like they were a fucking idiot in this movie.
Well, I mean, I think it treats its main character as an idiot, because, I mean, I'm sitting there as a rational person, you know, just like literally the most obvious thing that this scam could be, you know, it is. And the fact that he can't see through that because he's blinded by emotions, you know,
but especially he's not even initially attracted to her. Like, he says weird things to her about, like, your ears look good in certain light, and it's like, it's Emma Stone, what are you talking about? She's
That part did not ring true. That part was very hard to swallow.
Like, you didn't pick a quirky-looking actress. You picked Emma Stone. She's like the face of, I don't know, some, I know she's on my commercial, like, commercials advertising makeup and looking fabulous, making me feel bad about myself. So, like, it doesn't make sense to like be like, you're okay looking some of the time.
Right.
It just it stretches.
Right. And the point where he starts to believe, like where he's just like, oh my God, you're real. Like this is all happening. You can really talk to them. It felt like it was happening because it was supposed to happen at that point in the structure, not because of any evidence or any kind of building to an emotional crescendo.
Yeah, and there's some fun performances.
Yeah, I never bought it.
I thought Hamish Linklater's really funny as the rich heir that wants to seduce her. He's really funny in this.
Yeah, this sort of this moony-eyed ukulele strumming. He's the Baxter character basically, and he plays it so nicely, you know.
Yeah, and it's like, I mean, he would fit in Brooklyn today with his little ukulele and his heartfelt songs and his trust fund. But like, you know, it's just there wasn't enough in this for me. Like, if it were on like Turner Classic Movies on a Saturday where it's rainy out, I would probably watch it, but it's like I'm not excited about it, and that kind of bummed me out. Because like Blue Jasmine last year was amazing. Like I love Blue Jasmine, and it's like, I mean, it's part of Woody's thing where he delivers so many movies that it's like I guess they can't all be golden.
He's literally on a stretch now, and you know, and opinions on these vary, but for my money at least, he since 2010 has been on a one good one, one bad one. Pattern, because he had Tall Dark Stranger, which is one of his worst films in 2010, but then he had Midnight in Paris, which is wonderful, and then he followed that up with To Rome with Love, which is a very mixed bag.
I forgot then, that even happened, and I've seen that movie.
But then Blue Jasmine, which is amazing, and now there's this, which means whatever he puts out next year, the one he's shooting now with Joaquin and Emma Stone, is going to be fabulous, because that's how it works. Every other one now is really good.
So
yeah, well, I mean, I've actually talked to Woody Allen before, and it's like he admits that much. He says that like this is just basically something that he does as an exercise every year. You know, he'll write in the winter, he'll shoot in the summer. Some of them are good, some of them are bad.
That's fine. Depressing to hear him just be like, whatever, it's what I do. Like, I would.
But the law of averages says at least one out of every five of them should be pretty good.
So at least 50 of his movies are good at this point. So to wrap up, would you guys recommend people see this movie, and where do you think this ranks in the pantheon of Allen films?
I would say it's really only for your, you know, if you're a Woody fan, if you're a Woody follower, if you see everything he does and you want to see it and there are things to like about it, and it is gorgeous to look at. The locations are great and the costumes are cool and the cinematography is wonderful, blah, blah, blah. Not him working at top speed as a writer or director. I don't think it's among his worst. I don't think it is, you know, Curse of the Jade Scorpion, the Hollywood ending, Tall Dark Stranger level. But it's just kind of like about a notch above that. I'd put it around like whatever works, that sort of quality level, I would say.
Yeah, I would agree. I think this is the cinematography by Darius Kanji is wonderful. It's kind of wasted on a pretty lame script. I think this is for Woody completists only. But I do think that there is an article or perhaps even a book to be written about Woody's interest in magic, and which is a recurring motif in a lot of his movies, and especially stage magic. And he's been practicing magic since he was a child. And I think those themes run through this film, and it is essential for discussing that specific theme in his work. So I think that, you know, we might look back on this with a different opinion, but for right now, it just feels like it's forgettable.
Yeah, I'd agree, forgettable. Like, this one reminded me of Scooped, which is another magic movie that I forgot I had seen until it was, like, on cable one day, and I was like, oh, right, this is a movie.
I am a hardcore Scoop defender.
That happened.
I will take you on Scoop.
That'll have to be another episode, but
I will defend Scoop.
So let's move on. Funny enough, from another to another Scarlett Johansson movie. We're gonna go Scooped to Lucy. Guys, that just happened because.
Da 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 etc.
Everyone thanks you for that. That was lovely. For your I Love Lucy rendition. So Lucy is the new film from Luc Besson.
I actually was disappointed that there was I was actually disappointed there was no scene of Scarlett Johansson trying to eat chocolate off a conveyor belt. Really disappointed.
I heard that's in the deleted scene, so fingers crossed for the DVD release.
Yeah.
But this is a Luc Besson movie. Luc Besson is best known for Leon the Professional, La Femme Nikita, and The Fifth Element, and he's lesser known for a lot of dumb movies, frankly. And I'm a big Luc Besson fan because, guys, The Professional. So this one is about another killer, though she doesn't start off as a killer. Lucy starts off as a pretty average girl, but then through some circumstances that are bananas, she has drugs put into her organs, and she is made up to be a jug mule, and she mule, and she gets a beat, and the drugs bust open in her, and then they fuck with her head, and instead of using 10% of her brain, which is, that's just how this movie works, we're just going to accept that and move on, she slowly advances to the point where she hits 100%, and it's kind of like Transcendence, except actually fun to watch. I'm going to throw that out there.
Accurate.
It's bananas. Right? This movie is absolutely batshit crazy.
Yeah, there's all these big questions in the movie where, like, if you think you're just going to go see an action movie, haha, Luc Besson has things about evolution and mankind's place in time and all these big questions that... It's a 90-minute movie. There's really not time to be asking all these questions, but I kind of admire that he attempted. It is
a dumb movie that thinks it's really, really smart.
It really does. There's like an extended sequence where, yeah, like 5 minutes in, Lucy knows she's in trouble because she's found herself in a really shitty situation, and they keep cutting to, and I feel like I can give you this without spoilers, they keep cutting to an antelope being hunted by jaguars. They're like, I get it. She's in trouble, but they keep cutting back to it like, do you understand? Yeah. She's the antelope, and the guy from Old Boy, he's the jaguar. Like, no, I understood the first time you cut away, but you've done it 5 more times. So it's like Luc Besson's trying so hard because I feel like he just doesn't think mainstream movie audiences are terribly smart. So, okay.
He did make a fortune on, I had such a good quip, and I lost the title of the movie. Transporter. He made a fortune on Transporter movies, so we can't blame him for underestimating the intelligence of the movie.
Fair point. There were some people here.
This movie is...
I don't get this, and I was like, okay. Well, there's a lot of exposition, so I don't know why you're not getting it, but okay.
Right.
This movie is literally like, it's like if Terrence Malick, or it's like the Wachowskis made that movie he did...
Tree of Life?
Tree of Life. It's like the Wachowskis made Tree of Life. Or if it's like a 6-year-old wrote Limitless, where it's just like, it's just like, and then Scarlett Johansson, she can talk through the phones, and she can just come into the room because she knows you're there already, and she can make the bad guys drop and fall and float up in the air.
That's amazing, because everything ridiculous. Max said actually happens in the movie, and I can completely see this being explained by an 8-year-old. I have to say, like, as flawed as weird as this movie is and as many things it tries to do, I had a really good time with it, and a large part of that is that Scarlett Johansson is amazing.
Right.
Like, we saw her earlier this year just be outstanding in Under the Skin, and what's interesting is this is kind of a reverse of Under the Skin, where in that she played an inhuman character that had to learn to be human, and in this she plays a human character who slowly becomes inhumane because of the way her brain is expanding. Very Dr. Manhattan. And
it's Dr. Manhattan after a trip to Sephora.
Oh, she's so pretty. I mean, like, that's the thing, though. She's always been gorgeous to look at, and she's in, even though they have her basically, like, roughed up a bunch of times, she's still gorgeous to look at, but, like, Scarlett Johansson understands her star power, she understands the effect the camera has on her, and vice versa, and she's amazing in action sequences. It was really fun to watch her, and, like, because Marvel keeps being like, oh, who knows about a Black Widow movie, like, this might be the best thing we get for a while, and I'm very excited that it at least exists, even though it's really weird and strange, and those are synonyms.
Yeah, I mean, it's weird, but it's not, I don't know if it's like cult movie weird. It's just kind of like, I'm not mad that I saw this weird, because it's...
That's your pull quote. Like, I'm not mad that I saw
this. It's like, if you're on an airplane and you have to choose between this and the Judge Judy rerun, watch this, please. But otherwise, I mean, it's like, it's not essential. This is not essential filmmaking.
It's not essential, but I don't know.
I found it weirdly essential. I found it for summer that is dominated by dumb boy movies.
Here's a dumb girl movie.
It's a dumb girl movie, and you know what? Yes, thank you. That there should be more of them. I approach this in a sort of unusual way because I decided that the thing that I was going to write about it, which I will later this week, keep an eye out, I had never actually seen La Femme Nikita. I'd seen his other films. I'd seen Leon the Professional a whole bunch of times, and Fifth Element and a few other things, but I just had never gotten around to it. And so I watched La Femme Nikita the night before I watched Lucy. And there's a compelling case to be made that Luc Besson is one of the few sort of marquee male action filmmakers who gives a shit about creating interesting female action protagonists.
Yeah, it's like him and Ridley Scott are the only two. And maybe Joss Whedon.
Yeah.
I don't know that Joss Whedon's done.
But the problem is they're not always they're not always the best. Like, did that Joan of Arc movie, which is a piece of crap. I mean, like, the Fifth Element.
They're not always the best,
you know,
but it's, like,
I don't have beer. I do not have beer goggles for the Fifth Element. Like, the Fifth Element.
The fact
people
that
don't
you
want
say
to admit that.
I will end this podcast right here.
The Fifth Element sucks a big old French baguette. I'm just gonna put it out there.
How
it really does,
sir. Bruce Willis has blonde hair and a big gun. What are you talking about?
That's sacrilege.
I can't even
but
with you right now.
But I went into Fifth Element. I went into Fifth Element thinking it was going to be a serious science fiction movie, and it's just like, it's just Die Hard in space.
Have you seen
the
Luc Besson movie? Like, that's what I like about Luc Besson is, like, he goes on these romantic weird tangents. Like, Lucy is not the movie I thought it was going to be from the trailers, but then it wouldn't have been a Luc Besson movie if it had just been, like, you know, right. As people in comments have been saying for a lot, you know, it's just female limitless. Like, I mean, yeah, but mix in Tree of Life and weird big questions, and, I mean, you know, it's just...
And Kick-Ass, you know, there's the shot in this movie... where it's a slow-mo shot of her walking down a hotel hallway with two guns in hand and opera music's playing, and I swear to God, it's like the second thing I've seen in a movie this year. Like, it is perfect. I like the fact that he is willing to sort of mix it up tonally, that he is willing to deliver both the sort of shoot-'em-up stuff and the
heartstring stuff, like the phone. There's a point where she calls her mother because she thinks she's dying, which understandably, there's a lot of things have gone down, and she calls her mother. And like, when I was in film school, we were taught flat out, don't write phone conversations. They're boring. They're never interesting. You never see, like, you know, there's just, they're bad ideas. And this scene disproves that by having Scarlett Johansson deliver this really amazing, effectively monologue to her mother that paints an entire world around Lucy. Like, we've only known her about 10 minutes, but in that week, we see a place of her as a daughter and within this world where people love her and care about her and how she feels so powerless to change what's happening in her life. And it's like, I mean, they had me at that point. I was just like, I'm with you, Scarlett. Let's just do this. And, like, the movie makes some really strange choices, and it's odd, but it's, like, it's 90 minutes. And honestly, in a summer where we have just been handed so many big, fat, bloated blockbusters, mm-hmm. I was perfectly content to just be on this romp, even though it doesn't totally make sense. It was exciting, and it played with my head a little bit, and it showed me things I did not expect to see.
Yeah, it's very efficient. It's tight. And I also thought that he did some really interesting things, particularly in that opening segment, with perspective, just in terms of we only know what she knows. We see everything only sort of from her viewpoint, and it creates a sort of immediate sympathy to her that was, I think, really important in terms of how batshit crazy the rest of the movie was going to get.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I mean, the one thing you have to admit about the movie is it commits fully to this premise.
Yeah.
And
There's no winking at, like, we know what we're doing. Like, it's all just like, no, we're like, it wears its heart on its sleeve and it goes for it. And, like, I like that.
Yeah.
So, would you recommend
Plus,
Lucy?
If you're going to get somebody to explain the inner workings of the human brain, you get Morgan Freeman. It's just what you do. That's how you do
in
it.
In a wood panel.
He teaches a 20-minute class in this movie.
It's really long. It is like sitting in an actual lecture, Morgan Freeman just being like, and more things about the brain I've decided. Yes. He has no proof. It's just him explaining what the plot's going to be, but it goes on for a while, so it's pretty
funny.
He has
that show, Through the Wormhole, is that what it's called? It's like they literally just took like a segment from that show and just spliced it into this movie.
But there's
along with
really
some National Geographic footage.
Like, I even, like Annalee Tipton shows up one sec to just be, like, Lucy's roommate, and, like, I was so excited to see her, because she needs to have bigger parts. She's always just, like, the quirky best friend. But she's funny in this, and she, again, she paints this world where you understand who Lucy is because of the people around her. Right. And, like, as Lucy becomes more and more Dr. Manhattan, you need characters to have emotions around her, and they fill the gaps with that really well. There's, like, an international cast that's interesting and full of faces you may not know, and I don't know. I had a really good time with this. I'm just kind of still... It's a weird concoction, but I like it.
Yep.
So would you
it's
guys
okay.
recommend this weekend? Max doesn't regret seeing it, so...
I do not regret. I regret nothing. Yeah, I mean, what I'll say is I'll say buy a ticket for Transformers and then go see Lucy, because Transformers need your money, people. It really does. I'm going to just throw that out there.
You need to support little films like Transformers.
I mean, I just want to be an advocate for independent cinema. That's what I want.
For cinema, it's asking the tough questions, like about Texas statutory rape laws.
Exactly.
Because that's a real thing that happened this summer. I just keep pointing that out, because how did that happen? Anyway.
Say hi to your mother for me.
Oh, man. So, yeah, it's weird. It's an interesting week for movies, and it's also Comic-Con. So we'll be cutting to Perry and Angie and their adventures at Comic-Con. But before we do that, I'm going to give the guys a chance to give you their information. And in case Perry doesn't in her section, we're Popcorn Prosecco, at Popcorn Prosecco on Twitter. Subscribe to us on iTunes. Thanks for coming in. Jason, you want to take it?
Yes. Hello, I am Jason Bailey. You can follow me on Twitter at Jason-Bailey, spelled out, or you can read my stuff at FlavorWire.com, where I am the film editor. And my book, aforementioned book about Woody Allen, will be out in October. My previous tome, a 20th anniversary celebration of Pulp Fiction, is at online retailers and fine local independent bookstores nationwide.
Max?
I am Max Avery. I am a freelancer about town here in New York. I just did an interview with Rob Reiner for AM New York, which if you got the print edition of that, please pull it out from under your dog and read the interview I did with Rob Reiner. It was Wednesday. It was today, actually, Wednesday the 23rd. And I did a video interview with Jackie Weaver and Colin Firth for Magic in the Moonlight, and I did a one-on-one with Jackie Weaver as well. You can see both of those at blackfilm.com. And I'm Max Avery. It's M-A-X-E-V-R-Y on Twitter.
Thanks. And I'm at Christy Puchko, and I'm all over the place, but you can keep up with my highlights at decadentcriminals.com. So thank you so much for having us in your ears and eyes, potentially. I meant to thank you two for being on the show, and then I went in a weird direction with it. But thank you, Jason. Thank you, Max. It was a joy having you on. Thank you for being a part of the show.
Thank you for having me.
All right.
And to Perry and Angie at Comic-Con.
Hello from San Diego Comic-Con.
Hi.
So Christy's hosting back at home in New York because both Angie and I are here at Comic-Con 2014, and we wanted to tell you guys a bit about some of our favorite and least favorite things of the con. We're going to start with the least favorite. Angie, do you want to share yours first?
All right, so this wasn't honestly that bad, but one of the bigger disappointments for me this year was the Marvel Hall H panel, which, like, I guess the last few years they've closed out Saturday in Hall H, which is the biggest panel, and, like, you know, and, like, usually they have, like, you know, it's exciting, they have, like, they do things, they have, like, surprises. Like, if you've seen that, like, video of, like, Tom Hiddleston coming out and, like, you know, telling people in Comic-Con to kneel, yeah, that is from, like, one of their previous panels. So everyone was, like, expecting big things. It's the kind of thing that, like, people wait in line for, like, over 24 hours to get into.
People were sleeping outside last night at 6 p.m., I think.
Yeah, for this panel, which is at the end of the day on Saturday. And, you know, honestly, it wasn't that it was a bad panel, but it was just that it was just kind of a letdown. Like, I wanted them to, like, go out big, and they didn't. Part of the problem, I think, was that, like, it sounded like they had a few things that they were hoping to get together that didn't.
Well, Ant-Man was all screwed up, wasn't it?
Yeah, like...
And Evangeline Lilly hasn't read the script.
You get the feeling that, like, number one, like, the fact that Ant-Man was delayed kind of screwed it up, because I feel like they probably expected to have that footage to show at Comic-Con.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you also get the feeling that, like, if you've heard those rumors that Joaquin Phoenix is playing Doctor Strange, like, a lot of people are speculating that, like, maybe Marvel was hoping that that would be a really big announcement that they could do, but they didn't.
They didn't do any Doctor Strange, right?
They did not even mention Doctor... The words Doctor Strange, I don't think, ever crossed their lips. And they also did this weird thing where they announced that Guardians of the Galaxy 2 is coming 2017.
Like, it was a big deal, but I heard about that a couple days ago.
Yeah, and which I think kind of took the wind out of their sails. And plus, there's, like, other movies that are coming before that we still don't know there. I don't know. Just all in all, it was, like, I don't know. I'm picking it as my worst, partly because it was, like, the biggest disappointment. It's not necessarily a bad panel, but, like, I was like, oh, like, this is one panel that I had really high hopes for that it was okay.
I think everyone did. All right. I'm actually going to play the same game. The panel that I had the most high hopes for was Penny Dreadful, because I was actually in Ballroom 20 to cover two things that day. I was there to cover Community, which I don't watch, so wasn't that thrilled about. And I was there to cover Penny Dreadful, which I watched over and over again and loved to death. Turns out I had more fun at Community than I did at Penny Dreadful, because during the Community panel, there was, like, a liveliness, and they were excited to be there.
Yeah.
And they were saying interesting things about the whole switch to Yahoo and all that. During Penny Dreadful, I mean, really, there wasn't anything interesting to say, because the first season just wrapped, and they hadn't really planned anything for the second, so there was no, like, media information to get excited about.
Yeah.
And also, the stars, like, just kept mumbling. John Logan had some interesting things to say, but there was also Josh Hartnett, Harry Treadaway, and Reeve Carney, and they kind of, like, mumbled into the mic and just didn't have anything that I was, like, curious about at all. Another problem with that panel was the moderator. I forget her name, but I think she's a voice on Archer. And the problem with her was that she was just too much of a...
Is it Aisha Tyler?
Yeah, that's her. She was just too much of a fan. You know, like, all her questions were actually longer than their answers, and it was because she's like, I love this and this and this and this and this, and then before she knew it, she didn't ask a question,
yeah.
So that was a little weird. I was a little underwhelmed by that. I still love the show to death, but, I wasn't that thrilled with that.
Honestly, it sounds eerily close to an experience I had, I guess, one or two Comic-Cons ago, where, like, I was so pumped for the Game of Thrones Hall H panel, but, like, first I had to sit through the Big Bang Theory panel, which I watch a show, but I'm not, like, a super fan, but that was such
What year was this? Was this 2 years ago? I had the same reaction. When they gave out the space trip,
yes.
That, hands down, the most fun I had that day.
That was an amazing
panel. I was
good
there
panel.
To see Elysium. I didn't even last until Elysium, but that was supposed to be one of my, like, sit back, relax, and don't care things. I love that panel.
It was so funny, because I was sitting next to a bunch of people who, like, range from not giving a shit about that show to, like, actively hating it, and even they were like, that's a good panel. So then we were all like, oh, that was really good. Now Game of Thrones is on. George R. Martin moderated.
That was the worst Game of Thrones panel ever. Oh, I was so sad for people on that stage.
I didn't know it was possible for someone to be that bad at moderating, but George R. Martin was terrible. Anyway, this isn't this year, so I don't want to get too into it, but
that motorcycle, because that's necessary.
Yeah, sorry, we're recording outside, so we apologize for any bad lighting and sound issues. Moving on to our best panel.
I have two. Let me go first.
Okay.
I'm gonna go for the one that we didn't do together first.
Okay.
All right. So my favorite panel was Orphan Black. And first of all, I love Orphan Black. It's one of my favorite TV shows on television right now. But I also love that panel because the people in that show are really freaking special.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing ever gets old with them. Like, they must have been asked these same types of questions over and over again, but they answer it so thoughtfully and passionately. And so what happens basically is, at a certain point in the panel, the moderator calls for fan questions and everybody lines up, and a lot of people ask stupid fucking questions and, like, profess their love to the stars. I was in Vampire Diaries today, and I could probably count on, like, two hands or more how many people told Ian Somerhalder he has great eyes.
Yeah, and then they ask, like, some half-assed question where it's, like, clear that they just went up to
pretty
be
much.
Like, I love you!
See, now, there was some of that in Orphan Black, but it was, like, to another level. Like, there was this one girl who got up there, and actually, like, I started tearing up a little. She had told a story about how Orphan Black inspired her to come out and how it saved her life.
Wow.
And she wasn't particularly articulate at the beginning, so I'm, like, sitting there, like, rolling my eyes, and all of a sudden, I'm just like, I get it. Like, that's amazing. Like, that's what shows are all about.
Yeah.
And, like, on top of her being really moving, their response was really moving, too. Like, it so clearly touched Tatiana Maslany that I'm like, you guys are doing something special. You know you're doing something special. You appreciate it. And you appreciate your fans, too. And that goes a long way. You know, they haven't gotten anywhere close to finalizing details on season 3, so there was no news or anything like that. But it was almost like a tribute to the second season, where it's like, look at all this great shit we did, and look at all your favorite scenes, let's talk about them, have fun, and all just like celebrate the fact that we love this show. Really appreciate that. That's a great cast, a great show. Check that out. We need more of that here.
So I'm going to cheat and choose two different things, and one of them is even a cop-out, so I'm horrible. But, okay, so I think honestly, one of my favorite panels I saw this year was also in Hall H, and it was the Women Who Kick Ass panel. I think Entertainment Weekly sponsors it. Tatiana Maslany, who you were just talking about, is part of it, too. And it's got her, it's got, like, Katie Sagal from Sons of Anarchy, it's got, like, Maisie Williams and Natalie Dormer from Game of Thrones, Nicole Beharie from Sleepy Hollow, and I feel like I'm missing at least one person.
I feel like I even read that lineup too. I should know.
Anyway, but the point is, it's like you know. So it's exactly what it sounds like. It's a panel of women who kick ass, and I felt like it's such a testament to how enjoyable this panel is that it was the last panel before Marvel, and people were not pissed off about it, because you would expect, like, you know, if you're the last panel before Marvel, like, people are gonna be like, well, fuck, like, you know, hurry up, I want to like, get going to the good stuff. But people were really engaged, and it's because it was these women that, like, don't necessarily. Like, you know, every other, like, most of these Hall H things have, like, you know, oh, it's Ben Affleck as Batman and whatnot. And it's, like, you know, these, like, women who, like, they get a lot of fan love, but they don't necessarily get the chance to, like, be center stage with their own panel, and then to, like, watch them talk to each other about the kind of things that you don't hear people talk about on other panels. Because most other panels, especially in Hall H, are devoted to, like, oh, like, you know, when's the sequel coming out and, like, stuff like that. But, like, they got to talk about, like, you know, like, just, like, the stuff that interested them, like, you know, like... They got to talk about, like, sexism in Hollywood. They got to talk about, like, what superheroes they want to play. It was just, like, really fun, really inspiring. And so that was probably my favorite panel. But the other highlight I want to point out is the Avengers Age of Ultron clip. And I know I just said the Marvel panel was disappointing. And overall it was. But the one clip was, I thought it was so good. Did you see it?
I didn't see it. I was on that press line in, like, an entire room full of people that were swarming all the actors. It was interesting.
They showed, like, a clip, and then it becomes, like, a clip show, like, basically more of a traditional trailer, and that one has all sorts of juicy stuff that you can read about everywhere, including on our site, /film, and I'm sure, you're covering for
IO9. IO9, yeah.
Yeah, so I'm sure you can read about that, too.
So that is all we have from San Diego Comic-Con, or at least all the space that my phone can take, so thank you guys for checking out what we have.
Bye!
See you soon!
Imagine if we could access 100% interesting things begin to happen.